Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello and welcome to Powerhouse Politics. I'm ABC News Chief White House Correspondent Jonathan Carl.
And I'm ABC News Political Director Rick Klein.
Rick, it's game on. Campaign is here. We've got the resumption of actual political events. And in the case of the incumbent president of the United States, he's actually gone out there and he's resumed his rallies. We've seen him obviously in Tulsa, Oklahoma. We've seen him in Arizona, out in front of those crowds. And by the way, the crowds were just tremendous. I saw a release from the RNC that said that his event in Tulsa attracted 20 million people, perhaps the biggest crowd ever to witness a political rally. How does he do it?
It's absolute magic. This was, as campaign events go, what's known as in the science and the art, as a debacle.
Disaster.
Sorry.
Yeah.
First of all, there was nothing that was forcing President Trump to resume campaign activities at this time to try to organize something. He wanted to make a statement. He wanted to make a statement that America's back, that his campaign is back. He needed the psychological boost of a big crowd. As you know, he draws energy from these MAGA rallies, and they chose a place that was frankly snake bitten from the start. Tulsa, Oklahoma, originally scheduled for Juneteenth. He pushes it back by a day. But even that created the big shadow over this event, given Tulsa's history on race. But they go ahead with it. And the president and his campaign, they talk about a million RSVPs. And they had set up not just the 19,000 seat arena, but also a massive overflow stage for the tens of thousands of people who would watch a second presidential speech outside in the heat of Oklahoma, in the midst of COVID. It was going to be a statement, and it said something, but not anything like what President Trump wanted it to say. A third full. And he ticked through the typical speech and flew back, and all the stories afterward are about a campaign that is now in further turmoil amid a whole lot of bad things popping around his handling of crises and around polling.
How does the RNC though put out a statement like that? I mean, this is like, you know, Spicer take two, except even more embarrassing.
Yeah, I mean,
they literally did put out a press release saying 20 million people, you know, tuned in, and you know, what a great, tremendous, and wonderful. I mean, I think I don't know. I mean, obviously, it's the audience of one, right? I mean, it's
right, and it's often dictated directly by people close to that audience, as I've been told in the past.
Sometimes by very close to that audience,
very close.
One.
But
yeah,
why isn't the RNC saying anything about this? Why aren't we seeing anything about this? Why don't we know? Why aren't people pointing out these record numbers? You know, circle this and get the memo out. And yeah, it gets said, but it doesn't change the realities of this event. And Oklahoma is in the midst of record new cases, as is Arizona, where the president followed up just a couple of days later with another event, again with no mask, again with very little, if any, social distancing, all to make the statement that the president wants to continue to make. And John, you've been covering this crisis since the beginning, and as you know, he has consistently tried to convey the sense that we are out of the woods, that it's not a big problem, that things are okay. He said at the event in Tulsa that the numbers were only up because testing was up, so he told those people to slow the testing. I'm not even clear at this point whether he meant it or he didn't mean it. The White House says it was a joke. He says he wasn't kidding. It was just from the start, all unforced error upon unforced error. There was no reason any of this had to even happen. And yet it all has developed.
Now, the other guy, you know, this is a presidential race. So it turns out there are two candidates. I mean, there are actually more than two candidates, but there are two, you know, major party candidates. The other candidate is a former vice president of the United States, former senator from Delaware, a guy that grew up in Scranton, Pennsylvania, Joe Biden. And he's out there now. Well, I mean, he's out there. He is, right? Hey, by the way, before we get to Biden and what he was up to, can you just clarify something for me? When the Trump folks and others say, you know, Biden's stuck in his basement, they did let him out of the basement, right? He's not actually in the basement.
Yeah, it's a metaphorical basement at this point. They've built a nice studio for him that actually has a ground level view of the world outside. It's still in his house in Delaware, but technically, no, it's not. I mean, I'd love it if he did it from the man cave, right? Like you see some Blue Hens memorabilia, some Syracuse stuff in the background, things like that. But that's not quite what we're talking about. And you know,
like Wayne's World kind of a thing,
a little bit of a setup, you know. And he's gotten on a plane exactly once in the last 3 months. It was to go to Houston for a meeting with George Floyd's family. He's done a bunch of campaign events in Philadelphia area. Just, you know, the short drive from Wilmington. So he hasn't really left the greater Delaware area other than that one trip to Houston. But I think events like the one on Tuesday night tell you that sometimes they're going to be okay with that, John.
Yeah, exactly. Let the president go. But so here he's got, he brings out the big guns, right? He brings out the big guns. Obama's going to be a major presence in this campaign. This is not.
Yes, he will be. Yeah. You're going to see more of him and a lot of him. I've talked to people close to the former president. He plans to get fully engaged. You know, a lot of it is at the discretion, at the use of the Biden campaign. But this joint fundraiser that they had, you know, raised more of $11 million, also brought in, you know, talk about big audiences. The Biden campaign says 175,000 people donated to be able to watch this live stream. Will you take that? Not the millions that watched it on Fox News, but a lot of people saw what Barack Obama had to say, and there's a lot of Democrats that are eager to continue to hear him to say it.
All right, let's take a quick listen to part of what he said.
That suggests facts don't matter. Science doesn't matter. Suggests that a deadly disease is fake news, that sees the Justice Department as simply an extension and an arm of the personal concerns of the president, that actively promotes division and considers some people in this country more real as Americans than others. That we haven't seen out of the White House in a very long time. Good news, what makes me optimistic is the fact that there is a great awakening going on around the country.
As you point out, I mean, Biden now, from his metaphorical basement, occasionally getting out, he's got, you know, he's able to tap into to Barack Obama. He's able to watch the implosion or the apparent implosion of the Trump campaign over the last couple of weeks. Now, this is, you know, it's always, I mean, we've kind of been here before, but it's a pretty dark place right now. I mean, we had a new poll out today, Rick, that has Biden with a 14-point lead nationally. We've also seen polling in several of the key battleground states over the past couple of weeks that shows Biden with a less formidable but a pretty significant lead in virtually every state that he needs to win an electoral victory. The 14-point poll is huge, and I don't know if the race is really there, but it's not that much of an outlier. I mean, remind me where the Fox News poll was less than a week ago.
I think it was 12 points. Yeah, I mean, we're in that ballpark. But you want to know who's really freaked out by these polling numbers, John? Really chilled to the bone by the fact that Donald Trump has fallen as far behind as he has in these polls? Democrats. Democrats are actually more worried about these polls than Republicans. And it's not, and it really very little to do with, you know, don't trust the polls or just the top line of Republicans saying it's, you know, this fake news. The president believes that. Most Republican strategists recognize that the public polling is very strong and is something of an accurate snapshot right now. But Democrats don't want complacency, and they definitely don't want to fall into the same traps that they fell into in 2016, where the polls could bring a sense of lessen the stakes in any way of what this election is about. They need their folks to be fired up. And I'll tell you, over in Biden campaign headquarters, well, it's actually empty now. So I guess back in the living rooms of all the Biden campaign operators who would otherwise be in headquarters, they'd much rather this be seen as a 2 or 3 point race right now than a 14 point race, because they know it's not going to last for 4.5 months. And they also know that the real risks here are of Democrats thinking they got this in the bag.
The Fox News poll from almost a week ago had some fascinating things if you drilled down into it. And it was grim across the board, as you would expect, I guess, a 12-point top-line number. But a couple numbers that stuck out to me was, one is, do you think Donald Trump cares about people like you or not? And on this, it was a 20-point margin. Yes, 37%. No, 57% in the Fox poll saying they don't think Donald Trump cares for people like them. And same question was asked, obviously, do you think Joe Biden cares about people like you or not? And there, Biden, 47% yes, 41% no. Question on, do you think Donald Trump respects racial minorities? And in this poll, 21-point deficit on that for Donald Trump. 56% saying no, they do not think Donald Trump respects racial minorities, barely over a third saying they think he does. And the numbers were almost exactly the reverse when it came to Joe Biden. Those are tough things to overcome.
They're very difficult things to overcome. And in part, it tells you the difficulty of defining a guy who's as defined as he is. People went into the election last time already disinclined to like Hillary Clinton. And Donald Trump piled on that and took advantage of it and turned her numbers way worse than they were at the start of that campaign. Joe Biden is starting where people actually kind of like the guy. I saw a smart point made by one of the reporters who's on the ground over in Tulsa over the weekend, that you look around that rally and outside, there were all sorts of anti-Hillary lock her up type of t-shirts and memorabilia for sale. But according to Dave Weigel from the Washington Post, he couldn't find a single piece of anti-Biden messaging on any of that stuff. They haven't figured out how they're going to run against the guy, and the guy is sort of liked. And whether that's in the basement or far beyond, he starts at a higher level, and it's difficult to define a guy who's been as high profile in the public realm for the last dozen years. They don't start with a clean slate on him, and some of the meandering messaging from the president about how far left he is and what he would empower, and as he's not so subtly says whether he's all there mentally, all of that, it has to gel into something. But you're starting with a guy that people just generally like.
All right, so Rick, we got to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to take a deep dive, or a deepish dive, into Election Day. We just had some very interesting primaries in Kentucky, in New York, in North Carolina. Who knows what they mean? We're still waiting for the results in two of those cases, but we're going to have one of our favorite guests here on the Powerhouse Politics podcast join us, Mary Bruce, to take a deep dive on all of that. We'll be back in just a moment. All right, welcome back to Powerhouse Politics. Rick, this is a big moment for the Powerhouse Politics podcast, because we have a guest that I have to say is on my list of top guests on the Powerhouse Politics podcast. I mean, right at the top. Do you know who I'm talking about?
So much.
I don't know who you're talking about. I have no idea, but you can.
Mary Bruce. Mary Bruce of ABC News. Mary, thank you for joining us on Powerhouse Politics.
Thank you for finally having me, John.
I mean, we've been trying to book you for months. Trevor's been pulling his hair out. I mean, this is really big. But we wanted to bring you on. Well, we always want to bring you on. But we wanted to bring you on, especially at this moment, because we just had a series of primaries in some interesting places: South Carolina, New York, Kentucky, and interesting results. We especially know that you spent some time exploring the Kentucky Senate race, which we may not actually know the results of God knows when.
Yeah.
But extremely interesting race, and we know you've talked to both of the candidates for the Democratic nomination there. But before we get to that, I don't know where to start. Can we go to South Carolina, Rick? South Carolina, the president every Republican the president endorses wins, right? I mean, this is his party, 96% approval rating. He loves talk. I mean, so I assume, especially since this was a seat that was vacated by his new chief of staff, Mark Meadows, that, I mean, clearly the candidate that was endorsed by Donald Trump and Mark Meadows to get the Republican nomination to run for that seat must have won, right?
Yes, and of course, John, you know this is North Carolina, where Mark Meadows represented Congress.
All right. Can we stop yes. doing this all
no,
over
no,
again?
No, we know that. But no, this is fascinating because Mark Meadows.
Oh my God!
I'll tell you what's going on here. You know,
can we at least acknowledge that the president's previous chief of staff was from South Carolina?
Yeah, we can. Mick Mulvaney was from South Carolina. That's
right. Good cleanup. All right. Good cleanup.
Okay, thank you. My Lord.
So,
can you fix
John.
This in post? Can you fix this in post?
don't fix this in post.
They're gonna make me.
Don't you dare, right. Trevor.
Don't you dare.
I got nervous with Mary Bruce on the line. I got a little nervous.
Oh, blame me. Yeah, right.
All right, go ahead, Rick.
So Mark Meadows leaves Congress. It seemed that the timing of his resignation, which came very late, you remember he was almost acting chief of staff while he was still in Congress. It seemed like he was trying to crowd out other potential candidates to try to get a friend of the family into it. That person wins the first round but goes to a runoff. And Linda Bennett, who was that candidate, actually loses, though, in the second round to Madison Cawthorn, who is 24 years old. You'll know from your constitution that you have to be 25,
right?
So he turned 25 before the election. So we're good on that front. But he is a fascinating personality. He was in line to go to the U.S. Naval Academy, had a terrible car accident, was paralyzed from the waist down. He's been documenting his physical recovery, his training for the Paralympics, and really the inspiring story of his comeback, and he rides it all the way now to being the favorite in a very Republican seat in North Carolina. And he says, even though Donald Trump and Mark Meadows endorsed his opponent, he immediately got a call from Donald Trump. He loves Donald Trump. He says no one is going to be more Trumpy than he is, and he could be the face of a new freshman class of Republicans if he's able to hold on to that seat this fall.
And Mary, I imagine the Republicans will have him at virtually every press conference. Guy, 25-year-old, he'll be 25 by then. I mean, they need a little new blood.
Yeah, I was gonna say the Republican Party could use with a shift in demographic. That's for sure. It certainly would help offset some of the older ages of those up on Capitol Hill. But look, to Rick's point, this is a real burn to the president and to Meadows and to all of those who had, you know, essentially handpicked who they thought was gonna win. I think it really shocked a lot of the sort of establishment Republican Party to have this young up-and-comer, you know, real estate investor, sort of no one really heard much about, all of a sudden come out and really shock, I think, a lot of those who thought that this was really settled.
And the other interesting primaries yesterday was in the state of New York. Elliot Engel, powerful Democrat from New York in the House, this facing a progressive opponent. This all has echoes of a primary we saw in New York last time around. What do we know?
Well, this is, you know, a lot of people are sort of referring this to AOC 2.0 because you have this really shocking, what appears to be a shocking upset, where it's not, you know, this race isn't called just yet, but it does seem that Jamal Bowman is going to be taking Elliot Engel out of Congress. And it's, I think, a really surprising turn, but it in some ways is not, because it shows, I think, to the establishment Democratic Party, just the power again of the progressive left. Jamal Bowman, you know, is a progressive. He was supported by the big progressive powerhouses in the party, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And it just, I think, goes to show again a bit of a wake-up call to the Democratic Party in the same way that AOC's race was. And look, Elliot Engel has been in Congress for 31 years. He, of course, is, you know, the powerful chairman of the House Foreign Relations Committee. This is someone who has played a really prominent role in all these investigations of the Trump administration. And now it appears that he will be leaving because the party, once again, it seems, is opting to go, you know, for someone with a much more progressive vision for the future, and someone who also ran, you know, on a similar kind of message that AOC did, in the sense of saying, look, Jamal Bowman made the case that Elliott Engel was out of touch. And he was, in recent weeks, not spending a lot of time in the district. He was back in Washington. He also had a hot mic moment that got him in a lot of hot water. And it really just shows that I think a lot of these older Democrats who've been in power for a long time, it's not always a sure thing.
Okay, so
the country is changing, right? That's there's exactly. A theme here, Mary, of the country changing and Congress potentially changing just to reflect that.
And by the way, we should always point out that when we look at these races, the overwhelming majority of the time, the person you expect to win wins. But this is why we're taking a look at this. So Elliott Engel, as you mentioned, Mary, very powerful, you know, three decades in Congress, all of that. He also just as we saw in North Carolina. Elliott Engel had the support of some very prominent mm-hmm. Democrats. Nancy Pelosi, Adam Schiff, Hillary Clinton.
Which, of course, is a sign that they knew that this seat was vulnerable. When Hillary Clinton comes out and decides to enter and throw her name into a race for the first time, I think that's when everyone knew that they had a sense where this was headed. And of course, it speaks also to the broader moment that we're in. Jamal Bowman, of course, a younger black man coming in as we are seeing this real, you know, reckoning on racism in the country. And this is something, of course, that really is playing out in the race in Kentucky as well. But it's not just that you're seeing this shift to, you know, more progressive candidates in many of these races, but also younger, more diverse candidates. And I think you're going to continue to see that as we head, you know, into November as well.
Okay, so let's move to Kentucky. This is the Democratic primary for the right to take on Mitch McConnell, a race that most Democrats would acknowledge is not a high chance of success here, but they want to keep it competitive enough to force McConnell to spend a lot of money in his backyard and to give McConnell a scare. So here you have two Democrats competing, one who raised some $41 million. Do I have that right, Mary?
$41 million, astronomical amount of money
at this point during a primary. Yeah. And we don't know the results. But suddenly an upstart comes up and is, you know, I mean, like I said, who knows who's going to win this one? But this is, you know, right now looks very much like a race where we're going to be waiting for days, if not, you know, mm-hmm. a week or more to have the results.
What is so, I think, fascinating about this race is that just a couple weeks ago, it seemed that this was settled. Amy McGrath, the former Marine fighter pilot Amy McGrath, it seemed was a foregone conclusion. She had this massive fundraising power. She had been anointed essentially by the Democratic establishment. She's got Chuck Schumer out there speaking up on her behalf. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is supporting her. Of course, she ran in 2018, lost that seat, but they saw enough potential in her that they really wanted to push her for this race. And of course, you know, because this is Kentucky, they wanted to give Mitch McConnell a run for his money, quite literally, even though they didn't think that there's a real chance that they're going to take McConnell out of power. I think Democrats in Washington thought if they can at least force Mitch McConnell to have to focus more on this race, to have to raise more money for this race, well, then that's a win politically for Democrats. That's how this race appeared to be, you know, going a couple weeks ago. And then everything changed. The pandemic changed a lot of things. And then, of course, this push for racial equality. And all of a sudden, you have the underdog getting a lot of attention. It's Kentucky State Representative Charles Booker. He's the youngest black lawmaker in the state. And he has become this fixture out at these protests. And he's really tapped into that energy in the streets of Kentucky. And of course, you know, Kentucky's an interesting sort of microcosm of all of this, because it's not just what happened in the reaction to the killing of George Floyd, but of course, Breonna Taylor in early March. They have had they have been, you know, dealing with the fallout from these horrific police shootings for many, many weeks now. And, you know, speaking with Mr. Booker, he explained to me how a lot of this is really deeply personal for him. Not only does he represent what he likes to say is the poorest zip code in the state, but he also has a personal connection to a lot of this. Take a listen.
I carry a lot of trauma. I've had cousins murdered the last 4 years. And my cousin TJ was murdered on Easter Sunday, 2016. was really good friends with Breonna Taylor. And it hurts. It hurts even right now. And I've used that pain, and I'm standing with them even when I got hit with tear gas myself. And I think it showed the people of Kentucky that they can support me in my candidacy because they know I'm going to fight for them.
And I think it's not just that he is out there kind of giving a voice to these concerns of protesters across the state and across the country, but he also, like in New York, is a young progressive. You know, this is someone who's out there calling for a Green New Deal, pushing for Medicare for all. And so you have this kind of convergence of what's being exposed by not just this, you know, national reckoning on race, but also a lot of the concerns coming out of how the pandemic is disproportionately affecting the Black community that is really also, I think, raising a lot of interest in his platform as well. And he's convinced that, you know, even though Mitch McConnell, as he says, has been in office since the year that Booker was born, he is convinced that this time around they have a chance to finally get him out of office. We'll see.
And Mary, one of the things that makes this so interesting, we should note that after Election Day returns, he's down in the single digits to Amy McGrath, who I want to talk about in a moment, although we haven't seen any results at all from the two largest counties, most populous counties in the state. So the thinking is he could still make up the gap, particularly in cities and counties that have larger minority communities. But one of the things that makes this race so interesting is as you've pointed out in your reporting, this was a race that the Democrats had really settled on a candidate on. And Amy McGrath was not even, you know, your run-of-the-mill person picked from obscurity. She was a star in 2018. She was an enormous presence in the 2018 cycle, one of the real kind of poster children of this wave of young women running for Congress, a former Marine fighter pilot, mother of three, who came close to winning an upset in a House race and immediately turns around and runs for Senate. And then comes the latest events of the last couple of months, which have upended politics all over again. I'm fascinated by how quickly things can move. And as Charles Booker told you, it seemed like events were just kind of catching up with this election.
Exactly. And I asked him that, you know, why has this shift happened so quickly? I think we have some of that sound, too.
And, you know, just a few weeks ago, Democrats really thought they had this race planned out. What happened?
Kentuckians are used to being ignored. We're used to being counted out. We're used to being written off. People talk about Kentucky. They talk at us. They tell us what we think. They tell us what we believe in. Never listen to us. I would not have wished a pandemic. I would not have wished in a million years for Breonna to lose her life. But we're doing justice by her life now. We're doing justice by the pain we feel now. And we're fighting back.
And you know, he says they're fired up and that people are finally listening and paying attention. And I think that's a message that you're hearing, you know, across the country. And what's so fascinating to me about these races yesterday is that this really is this first test, right, of the political impact of this movement, of this kind of national moment that we are in. And, you know, we still don't know the results. And you mentioned that right now, you know, it does seem like McGrath has a bit of a lead. But even if she does end up winning this, I think it has been a real wake-up call to the impact of this movement, and also a wake-up call to the Democratic establishment that they may not have the power that they think to essentially anoint some of these candidates.
And
so what is McGrath saying? You talked to her as well.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about McGrath, you know, part of the challenge of the last few weeks for her has not just been that, you know, Booker has sort of been able to see this boost of momentum, but that she, you know, her critics point out, she kind of struggled in some ways to respond to this moment. There was this kind of infamous moment at one of the debates where she was asked, has she been out in the streets joining these protests? And she kind of stumbled and she said, no, I haven't. I was, you know, spending time with my family this weekend. And she was criticized for not kind of seeing and not being present enough at some of these protests and not sort of recognizing the magnitude of this moment early on. I asked her about some of that as well.
Your critics say that you've struggled to respond to this growing movement. What do you make of that criticism?
Well, look, I have been out listening to my fellow Kentuckians. I went to memorial services for George Floyd and Breonna Taylor in Central Park in Louisville. And I know that people want to tackle social injustice in this country, the racial injustice. We got to fix this. The real inequity is in opportunity. The real inequities in education. And that's why I want to go to Washington to be a voice to tackle some of these inequities and get it done.
Now, of course, you know, her critics say that she simply doesn't get it, but she's focused on what she would do, you know, if she makes it to Washington. And she recognizes that Booker had some momentum. She recognizes, obviously, that his life experience is very different from hers and that he can speak to the concerns of protesters in a way that she can't. But she also recognizes, I think, that his policies are very to the left, and she's not necessarily, I think, certain that that's a direction that a lot of Kentuckians want to go in. She's, you know, much more down the middle, although she says that, you know, she's an outsider too, that she is not, she doesn't come from a political circle in the same kind of way, that she's an outsider candidate as well, who can certainly pick up and understand and relate to the concerns of the left. So she recognizes the power of the left voice in Kentucky, but I think she also, you know, is focused on what she would do if and when she gets to Washington.
And Mary, shades of Bernie Sanders here, because the argument that that Charles Booker has been making here is that you need someone who can really fire up the base and get Democrats engaged in different ways. Whereas the establishment in Kentucky and in Washington, Amy Rath, endorsed quickly by the DSCC and Chuck Schumer and the like, has been you got to get someone that kind of looks like your state, it looks like your district, and the concern in Kentucky is. They've tried it before, literally against mm-hmm. Mitch McConnell 6 years ago. Allison Lundgren Grimes was the candidate, and a lot of people were excited about it. Got a lot of national attention, and she, you know, she got blown out of that race. Intriguingly, she's now endorsed Booker, and so yeah. it kind of comes full circle. And the question for Democrats about whether this is a new formula for electoral success, whether or not it's successful in Kentucky, it feels to me that. These primaries are really shaking up those assumptions. And whoever wins this primary and however he or she ends up faring against Mitch McConnell, there's some big lessons here about political organizing and what the power of movement politics in 2020 looks like.
It is a wake-up call, I think, for the Democratic Party. And, you know, McGrath, you mentioned she does have this, she had this incredibly successful race in 2018. And that's part of the story here that I want to make sure we don't lose, which is that she's become, you know, a well-known figure in the state. She's been boots on the ground for more than a year out there talking to Kentuckians, talking about their frustration. So, you know, while Booker had a late surge, Amy McGrath has been at this for a while now. She was not successful in 2018. You know, that people may say that was a sign that she wasn't a successful, you know, candidate, but she certainly has become a very familiar figure and has been at this for quite a while now.
So to both of you, as we sit here and wait for the results, and as I understand it, there's still a lot of votes to be counted in Kentucky. Rick, first to you, is this kind of a precursor to what we're going to see in the fall? I mean, if it takes this long to get the results in a primary race for a Senate race in Kentucky, what is this going to look like nationally?
This is the new normal, and everyone has to recognize it. If I could scream it into the microphone, I would, but I want to spare our listeners. Election day is not going to provide the winner of the presidency unless it's a landslide. There are just too many changes to the way people vote, including a vast expansion in mail-in and absentee voting. That's the reason that it's taking so long, is that there are way more people voting in New York and Kentucky by mail and absentee than ever have before. And this will be happening for, you know, New York and Kentucky. We know where they're going to land in the presidential race almost certainly, but we don't know about Pennsylvania. We don't know about Wisconsin. We don't know about Michigan. Those are just three of the states that are dramatically changing the way people vote, with no real way to handle the influx of voters that are coming in, plus a president who is actively trying to undermine faith in the very counting process. This is what is going to happen, and it's going to happen in big battlegrounds, and it almost certainly means that we're not going to know who the next president of the United States is when we go to bed on election night. And even people like us will stay up all night. We're still not even going to know. We're talking potentially days before you have enough vote in some of these big battleground states to be able to determine the presidency. That we're not used to, and we better get used to it as a country.
And Rick, you and I have talked about this, but it is just so bizarre to think about, now it is the norm that election days do not come with results. I think it's bizarre for us. It's a bizarre feeling, certainly for voters across the country. And when you think about November, I mean, part of what's so fascinating about watching this now, you know, we've had a couple, you know, states now where we can see this play out, is not just, you know, that it's a completely different reality, but that every state is different, right? So every state is facing different challenges, different geographical issues, different, you know, systems in place. In Kentucky, they opted to dramatically scale down the number of polling places. So each county only had one, the majority of votes coming in through mail-in ballots. So it's this sort of hodgepodge system, and everyone is in the same boat, that this is new for everybody. And it just, you know, the only thing that is certain is the unpredictability of it all. And you know, Rick, I think you're absolutely right that to add to that, you know, the fact that you have the president kind of undermining a lot of these processes is going to make for a really wild ride on November 3rd.
So I guess, Mary, we need to start resting up now for election.
Correct.
We're going to be like on, because the tradition is we stay on until there are results. So
we're going to stay on for a couple weeks.
Great. Yeah. Great. This is going to be good. I'm having a flashback to 2000. I don't know if you guys remember that presidential race. I was in Nashville at Al Gore headquarters. Getting ready to
that worked out
to cover,
right? No problem.
Yeah. It was good. I eventually made it home, but let me tell you, oh my Lord!
Yeah, and that'll be, you know, that could be a piece of cake compared to this. So
yeah. Oh my God! All right. Well, Mary, we know you have to get back to work. You know, Rick and I, we, you know, who knows what we'll do, but we know you have to get back to work. So thank you for joining us on Powerhouse Politics. The next time we come on, we'll actually ask, once we have a winner in Kentucky, is there a chance that Mitch McConnell could actually be beaten? It seems every 6 years or so, we raise this question. I remember just very quickly. I remember very quickly back in my CNN days. So it was probably, I mean, God knows which cycle it was. I honestly can't even remember. But I was I had gone and done a piece during, because it looked like McConnell was in danger, and I went to a place called Katie's Kentucky and saw him out on the campaign trail and of course went around with his opponent. And when I got back to Washington after the election, you know, there was McConnell at some stakeout with a bunch of Republicans, and he sees me and he goes, "You were in Katy's, Kentucky, and you smelled blood." But here I am. You know, of course, he won by a big margin. So I didn't smell blood. That. I was just covering your race. Oh, but trust me, he remembers that.
He does.
He's got a way of pulling these things out, but you never know.
I don't know. He's been there for 35 years. I wouldn't hold your breath on that one, John.
All right. Thank you for joining us, Mary, on Powerhouse Politics.
Thanks, for
Rick Klein and Trevor Hastings, Avery Miller, and our entire team. And it's a big, big team here at Powerhouse Politics. Thank you for joining us.